Ecclesiastes chapter 4. Review a little bit where we went on Sunday. We begin at verse 1. Again I looked and I saw all the opposition that was taking place under the sun. That's oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. Power was on the side of their oppressors, and they have no comforter. And I declared that the dead, who were already had died, are happier than the living, who are alive. But better than both is he who had not yet been, who has not seen the evil that is under the sun. We talked some about just how cynical Solomon sounded at this point when he looked out over things under the sun and realized that there was just a lot of oppression that was going on. I can't help but wonder a little bit, he being the king, if he was not the oppressor at times. But he could see the oppression that was going on, how some were affected by that, and thought, what a horrible existence, what a horrible life. Better yet is he who's not even been born and doesn't have to deal with that. Better even than that is one who's never to be born and not have to deal with that. He goes on in verse 3 or verse 4 to say, and I saw that all labor and all achievement spring from man's envy of his neighbor. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. The fool folds his hands and ruins himself. Better one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind. He kind of talks about two extremes and then draws a conclusion. The extreme of one who is all about work. Labor is all that he knows. Labor and achievement. You know, spring because of envy, perhaps, of his neighbor, seeing what his neighbor has. You know, this is the workaholic, perhaps. The one who just works all of the time. Then there's the other extreme. The one who's lazy, who doesn't want to work at all, and ruins himself because of that. And then the conclusion where he said, better is one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil. We can see the extremes. Those who have ruined themselves because of lack of work. Those who have ruined themselves because all they know is work. You know, the harder you try to get to that next rung on the ladder, the more time it's going to take, the more effort it's going to take, the more it takes from you, the more it takes from your life, the more it takes from your family. There's a price to be paid for that. And we can get caught up in that so very fast, so quick. Solomon saw it. Perhaps it was Solomon who was involved in that. Because this is a book about all the accomplishments of his life. He was busy all the time until he came to this point of reflection. And he's drawing this conclusion. It's better just to have one handful and have that with tranquility than two handfuls with toil, it's just chasing after the wind. And so on Sunday, we kind of came to that point, and we look on then at the next point that he goes to make in verse 7, and we'll make some comments. I'll be looking for some comments. Again, I saw something meaningless under the sun. There was a man all alone. He had neither son nor brother. There was no end to his toil, yet his eyes were not content with his wealth. For whom am I toiling, he asked. Why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? This too is meaningless, a miserable business. Description perhaps of someone who is now stepping back kind of disillusioned. Here's my life. All I've done is worked my life away. I have not a son to pass it on to. I don't have a brother that can take this. Well, don't you have to ask, why is he still working all the time? And what's he working for? What are some thoughts that come to mind with this? What are some applications that we can start making? We may have to look at ourselves a little bit. What comes to your mind? Why doesn't he slow down? Work and excelling in this way has become a purpose for life, for him. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very true. You do. You do. You have to fill it with something. That's a good point.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not about money.
Yeah. 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 It's what they are. It is who they are. Okay. Other thoughts? It's true too. What about this guy? Was it enjoyment still for this guy? Yeah, it kind of seems to be kind of holding that to himself, you know. There was no end to his toil, yet his eyes were not content with his wealth. This starts to tell us something different about this guy, doesn't it? Yeah. All right. What's his problem? Yeah, there's this love of money and having all of these things. For whom am I toiling, and why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? He recognizes the fact that maybe he could find some enjoyment if he wasn't just working all the time. If he wasn't concerned just about making money, you know, that there was more to life. He saw that, but yet he just seems like he still just couldn't quit. He couldn't slow down long enough to see that. Have you noticed that sometimes the happiest people are not always the most prosperous people around? Yeah. I mean, I think I've seen the extremes sometimes. I think I've known some who had considerable wealth. And I'm going to tell you what, in many cases, they were not the happiest people around. I mean, they were so busy with trying to attain more or hold on to what they had that they found no enjoyment even with what they had. And many of us would have said, I'd be happy with what they have. But at the same time, I wonder if we would. We might fall into the same trap that they were stuck in. And so sometimes the happiest people around are not the ones who are the most prosperous, but those who are content with having something less. You know, Jesus taught, I think, some very good principles about that, that, you know, true happiness and life is found in peaceful contentment, really, with what you have and building relationships and things that are not monetary at all. And that needs to be a little bit more of a focus for us. Life can be very empty if you have everything that life can give you. And I'm wondering again if we're not getting a glimpse of something inside Solomon right here. I mean, he's talking about another man. I wonder if we're not seeing some of Solomon in that too. I mean, he has spent a lifetime trying and testing and experimenting with all of these things and has done all this work, and yet there still seems to be something missing in the life of Solomon. Other thoughts? Right. Yeah, you're right. Those can be happy people. Sure. Yeah. Something good. Sure. Yeah. And find joy in that. Yeah.
And one of the points that he made to them, and it kind of relates to what's being said here, is that when I go out to McDonald's, just like you do, and he named off several things that are pretty much like everybody does. And he said, the only thing that's probably different about me in my life, and apparently he lives in the same house that he grew up in. And he hasn't built a huge mansion or something like that. I like the house. You know, it serves well, and I'm keeping it. It's just the house I grew up in. And he said, the only thing that's different about me and perhaps you is the way I travel. You know, I can get anywhere I want to be pretty quickly. Because he's got his own.
Yeah.
And such like that.
Yeah.
So raise a family on and, you know, do well. Other jobs made a lot of money. The job that I happen to have has made a lot of money for me. But you can be just as satisfied with something because I essentially do the same thing that everybody else does.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't that much different about the way that I live.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So when you earn your millions, now you know how to act. You'll be all set, Liz. That's interesting perspectives because, you know, so very often those who are seeking money and wealth, that's not the attitude. You know, that's demonstrated, unfortunately. That's what Solomon was saying, you know, a long time ago. And so it does give us some warnings here. It's nice to know that there's some people that haven't got caught up in all of that. But here's the issue and here's the problem that so many have. Okay, let's go on a little bit farther. Solomon goes on to give some other advice here just on life's survival, perhaps. In verse 9 he says, "Two are better than one because they have a good return for their work. If one falls down, his friend can help him up, but pity the man who falls and has no one to help him up. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm, but how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken." Okay, let's think about some applications that we might make with this. Two are better than one. I think in context here, it's talking about, you know, friendships, really. True friendships are hard to make. Have you noticed that? I mean, to have really, really good friends. I think in Christ, we have a real leg up compared to many in the world. You can move to town and you automatically have some friends, you know, brethren. And that's kind of interesting. And some people don't understand that at all. I mean, you know, Just talking with people, getting my hair cut and stuff like that. Well, have you made any friends? Yeah, about 70 so far. My first thing, my haircut. Have you made any friends since coming? About 70. Really? That's really fast. I said, well, it's my church family. You know, it's like, you know, some people don't understand that. You know, they don't have that. You know, and so here in the overall context at this point, he's talking about the strength and the power that can be found in real friendship. At least that's part of what he's saying. Some other points that he makes with this here. Two are better than one because they have a good return for their work. Well, two, it seems, can so often, when working together hand in hand, can accomplish a whole lot more than one can. Have you noticed that? I mean, if you spend double amount of time, you can't get done what two working together can do. You know, years ago when I back in Tennessee, when I was first, you know, we were starting to raise some cattle, my neighbor befriended me in just some very nice ways, and we did a lot of work. We ran some cattle together for a number of years, and there's always work around the farm. There's always fencing. There is always fencing to be fixed. It doesn't matter if you put it up yesterday, there's more fence that's to be fixed today. I don't know what it is about it. You know, there's always just work to do. And my point with that being is that we could just seemingly both readily admit we get so much more done when we work together, and we could coordinate some things together. And we can make a lot of applications to that. We see how that works. And so there's the idea of working together, but I think tied in with that too is just the friendship. I mean, like my cattle buddy, I can still call him up and we can talk about things, and there's a friendship there that's going to be a lifelong kind of friendship. Sometimes those are hard to find. You know, and there's great value to that kind of friendship that you don't want to let go of quickly. You don't want to let go of that at all, really. You know, because that's something that's kind of nice. Solomon's point here is about the labor part of it. But boy, so much more can get done when you work together. You know, he goes on to say, well, there's some encouragement to those who are weak, because if one falls down, his friend can help him up. You know, there's that, you know, the help that's readily there, and that kind of encouragement. There's not any of us that come to a point where we don't have or have need of some encouragement from time to time. Well, again, with brethren, we have a built-in system of that. I don't necessarily think that Solomon is talking about those who may be brethren. He's talking about it in a broader perspective here, I think, in the text. Tell me, what are some of your thoughts on these points? You know, what Solomon is saying here, two are better than one because they have a good return for their work. And if one falls down, his friend can help him up. What are some thoughts you would have, Earl?
You may be contrasting the man who had no dependents.
Yeah, the one who worked alone.
Mm-hmm.
But why didn't he have a friend? Yeah. Does that not stand out to anybody else? You know, that seems like there's something there. You know, I mean, I'm glad you said that. What else? What are the thoughts? Key point right here. A young lady we know from back in Tennessee. I saw a post on Facebook here just recently. This girl just wore us out. You ever have somebody you can't reason with at all? And you'd have no idea who this is, so I can say something about it. The times we have talked with her about, you know, she'd be bemoaning the fact again, you know, there's no one she can depend on. She has no friends. Hun, you have to be friendly to have friends. I mean, I became very blunt. You are not nice. You don't have friends because you run them off. You are not friendly to people. And it seems as though it has just absolutely escaped this girl. I know nothing else to be able to tell her that. But what you're saying is exactly right. You know, Proverbs 18:24, I believe it is, he who has friends must first be friendly. I mean, it's sort of common sense, I think, but it's scriptural too. You know, the idea with that. Other thoughts? Dave? Sure. Should be. That's right. Makes for a lovely marriage, indeed. All right. Other thoughts? Right, right. Sure. Yeah, that's right. And that's the advantage we have as Christians. What a difference. Yeah, very true. All right, good thoughts, good thoughts. Look a little bit farther. We go on to verse 11. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves, and the cord of three strands is not quickly broken. When we are most vulnerable, it sure is nice to have a friend close by that says, "I'm here with you." You know, and there's that kind of support. In some ways, the way this is written here, though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves, just talking about an aggressive type of a situation, I think. You know, but we can make some analogies to that as well. There's some advantages to having friends standing close by. What can you say to that? If two lie down together, they will keep warm. How can one, here's the point, how can one keep warm alone?
A lot of comments have been made this evening about the church Mm-hmm. People often try to remove themselves from the church and say, oh, I can just do this alone, or oh, there's just a bunch of hypocrites there. But
yeah.
That's the most detrimental thing you can do to
sure.
your spiritual health.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There is strength in number, probably what he's saying. What else would you say? Listen. Sure.
It's easier, it's better.
Sure.
And you can make it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Yeah, the context is not really talking about marriage, but we can see the application that can be made on so many of these points right here, powerful points that are being made. You know, the world can be a very cold and scary place when you're standing there all alone. I mean, at some point in time or another, we've all been somewhere where we've been alone. We've had anybody stand with us. And that can be a scary time and a scary place. What a blessing it is. Again, we think go back to the idea of the church family again. We never have to stand alone, you know, when with one another. And obviously with Christ, we never stand alone. You know, what a blessing and what power, you know, is found in that. Something just came to my mind. You can get so tired of fire department stories, but I have about 8,000. Real quick, this talking about having somebody stand with you. One night we'd gone to a structure fire and quickly put out the fire and quickly kind of determined that how did this start? It was suspicious in my mind. And so we secured the house and there's some family members that had come by and asked them to stand back. After a few minutes, this one guy who was somewhat inebriated walked in the house and I said, sir, you need to come back out of here. You know, we have an investigation going on. And he said, you can't tell me to get out of this house. You know, this is my house. And I said, well, as a matter of fact, I'm the commanding officer here, and I can tell you to stay out of this house. It's my house right now. And he says, it's not your house, it's mine. I said, no, as of time we got on scene, it was my house, and you need to come out of this house. And so then he told me how he was going to push my face into the dirt, basically, is what it was, in some other language, you know. And I stood there for a minute thinking, I believe he can do it. And I said, Jerry Petty's about this tall and about this big and just a good old country boy. I said, Jerry, come here. He said, what do you need me to do, Chief? I said, I need you to stand right here. You want me to take care of anything? Yes, I want you to stand right here. You need to get out of this house right now. And he left. I like Jerry Petty standing next to me. Great big guy. There's strength in too. Anyway. Let's look a little bit farther here at what Solomon goes on to say. In the latter part of the chapter, some concluding points here on this part of the text here. Better a poor but wise youth than an old but foolish king who no longer knows how to take warning. The youth may have come from prison to the kingship, or he may have been born in poverty within his kingdom. I saw all who lived and walked under the sun followed the youth, the king's successor. There was no end to all the people who were before him, but those who came later were not pleased with the successor. This too is meaningless. Chasing after the wind. So who's the old king, I wonder? Is that Solomon? Is he speaking of himself here at this point? Is he kind of looking at what's going to happen next? I mean, what's he seeing? What's he depicting here?
Going back to that endless cycle, he could be the young lad for that matter.
Mm-hmm. It's like he could have been reflecting on the time when he was the young king, when he was the successor. And there were some who were tired of David. You know, and he was the young successor. Well, here we are years later, he would be getting to be the old king now. So what's the idea? What's he depicting to us here? What do you see? Yeah. That's right. Yeah, yeah. Something that politicians have learned over time, right? Yeah. Some of the best kings may have been the ones who grew up more in poverty. Maybe not kings, but leaders. I mean, what about Joseph as a leader? I mean, Joseph had some really difficult times to deal with in his life, you know? And yet, even when he came to a position of power, he seemed to never forget where he came from, so to speak. David was a shepherd boy. You know, that's right. Yeah. I wonder if kings like Solomon had to struggle a little bit more. I mean, Solomon grew up with all the benefits of being the king's son. And that's not necessarily a blessing. You know, and people maybe looked at him different in that way. You know, David earned a place and position in the hearts of the children of Israel. And Solomon just kind of stepped into a position. I wonder how that made a difference that way. And if that has anything to do with some of the thoughts, you know, that he's talking about right here. I saw that all who lived and walked under the sun followed the youth, the king's successor. And there was no end to all the people who were before him. It's like he's saying, I've seen this happen over and over and over again. But those who come later were not pleased with the successor. I mean, they were waiting for the new king, the new successor. They could rejoice when the new king's put in place. But after a while, they became just as dissatisfied with the new king as they were with the old. Now, Solomon's son, Rehoboam, would have to learn that lesson in short order. You know, there were some who were delighted for him to become king, but not for long. That didn't last for long. You know. All right. Any other thoughts on that? On. Say it again. Yeah. Yeah. For a while. For a while, that's right. Yeah, and those opinion polls start to change pretty rapidly, don't they? Yeah.
I think you were also saying here that no matter how great I might be as the next king, people will get tired of me. There'll be somebody else to come along.
It just happens, don't it?
It happens.
Yeah. Just some thought questions here. Just kind of reflecting over chapter 4 a little bit. Solomon could see, you know, the influence of money and power, how that was oppressive, you know, to people. In what ways does that still happen today? Does it still happen today? Yeah, like some thoughts, comments. In what ways do we still see that happen today? mean, sometimes do we see that money, you know, is still influence?
Look at the label system.
Yeah. Yeah.
You've got enough money, you can pretty much get away with anything.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Taxes.
Yeah. Yeah, we can see that. I mean, money is power and power is influence. Or you can say it the other way around. It all still kind of comes out the same way. And so in so many ways, some of the things that Solomon was talking about hasn't really changed. I mean, it just really hasn't changed. You know, there's no... go ahead, Lauren.
Mm-hmm.
Have made it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. It's easier to respect someone who has done that, who's kind of pulled themselves up. You're right. We do. I think we all do kind of feel that way. Yeah. It's so obvious to see Solomon's cynicism in this chapter, more so than previous chapters, though we saw it there too. And usually he kind of brings it around to make some other conclusions as time goes on. And sometimes we become cynical. I mean, I have to admit, I mean, I look at some things with our nation right now, it frustrates me just so much I can't stand it. You know, and we can become cynical. I mean, we can come to the point of saying, well, you know, we had a little Bible study going on here earlier tonight. We were kind of talking about it. It's kind of like, man, it's just never been this bad. Well, yeah, it has. You know, if we look back far enough, there's cycles, there's ebb and flow of moral issues and financial issues and in all of that. You know, we come to the point sometimes of saying, there's never been a country that's heading down a road like we are right now. Well, yeah, there has. Yeah, that's right, you know. And so we need to look at Solomon's cynicism in this way and realize that in the end he was still just backing up and saying, you know, vanity of vanities. It's all meaningless. What comes will go and what goes will come. You know, that, and there is this kind of ebb and flow to life. In the big picture of some things he is saying is that we can overcome all of that. I mean, you have to see that through the cynicism when he starts drawing some conclusions, as we've already seen in the previous chapter. He's seen that we can overcome these things. And we have to try to grab hold of that too. I'm going to go back and touch on another point that we made going through. Solomon kind of made the point, it brought to our attention the extremes of the workaholic and the one who didn't want to work at all. You know, there are those extremes. And we can become very frustrated with those who are workaholics. That's all they know, that's all they want to do, and those who won't do anything. And it seems to me that part of the point that Solomon was making there around verse 5 or 6 or so was that there's a spot in the middle that works pretty good. And somehow we need to be looking for that. Yes, we need to work. We need to not be afraid of work. We need to find some joy, as he's already said, in the work that we do with our hands. You know, and rejoice in the things that we can enjoy with the work of our hands. But that cannot be the sum total of who we are. Nor can we be the other extreme, unwilling to work at all. There's a spot there in the middle that we have to kind of be working on. All right. Any other thoughts out of chapter 4? Let's look on a little bit. Let's go into chapter 5 and see if we can start off making some comments here before our class time is done. This is a very powerful passage here, these first, I don't know, 5 or 6 verses or so in this chapter. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. Go near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools who do not know that they do wrong. Do not be quick with your mouth. Do not be hasty with your heart to utter anything before God. God is in heaven, and you are on earth. So let your words be few. As a dream comes when there are many cares, so the speech of a fool when there are many words. We'll stop there for a moment and think about this. Kind of let these words kind of sink into us just a little bit. I mean, the chapter starts off here with just a view. At least I'm understanding this as a view of worship and how we would approach God in worship. And I think there's some real applications that we can make today, you know, from the text right here. I mean, surely Solomon was aware of those who would go to worship God and had many words to speak and were willing to make all kinds of vows to God. But the warnings that he has given here is that, you know, you need to be careful when you go to the house of God. You need to think about what you're doing. You need to think about why you're there. You need to think about who you are going to worship. Go near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools who do not know that they do wrong. Hey, that's pretty heavy stuff. Man, that's pretty powerful. Tell me what you think about that. What is he saying here? What's he trying to tell us? You know, it's a pretty simple rule right there, but I'm afraid we let that one slip by us sometime, where we start trying to tell God how we should worship Him. Not our place, not our position. What else? Gene.
I think he's taking to task those who are just going through the motions.
Yeah.
They're doing their sacrifices and all that.
The sacrifice of fools.
They haven't examined their own heart.
Yeah.
They know why they should be.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's
absolutely it does. Absolutely it does.
The term sacrifice here is well, it's the fool is really sacrificing.
Mm-hmm. Could be making an offering.
They're giving of their abundance. It's not sacrifice.
Could be.
And what they're giving is of their abundance.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good. Other hand.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was a sacrifice that didn't mean anything to God.
Exactly.
You know.
Why is that the case? It seems to be because they're not hearing what he has.
Mm-hmm.
Not asking him what he wants.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they could literally be offering a sacrifice, but God didn't consider it a sacrifice. For it could be for a multitude of reasons here. It didn't mean anything to God. All right. What's that got to do with us? Yeah.
If we are not sacrificing ourselves,
yeah,
for the right reasons, not examining ourselves, then God will not accept it.
An offering made by faith was accepted by God.
Not going to matter how much we put in the collection plate.
It's like misses the whole point. It does. You're right. Yeah, I think there's some applications we need to make off of this too. You know, it's very true. I mean, we can go through the motions, and it seems to me, and in part, that's what Solomon's talking about. Those who, I mean, it's not talking about those who are not worship, going to worship. I mean, they're going to the house of God. But what they were doing there was not acceptable to God. Absolutely. And that's having an effect on the Lord's church. I mean, in many ways. Because I've had these discussions with different ones, you know, at times where we can see what's happening in other churches. We can see what kind of results they may be having. You know, sometimes that works on us. You know, it's like, well, that works good. Or my friends at work are talking about how exciting their worship is. Or what they're doing, whatever it is. And we start wondering why we don't do that. Well, I mean, everything's worth investigating. But we have to compare it to what the text says. Because it is God who determines what worship should be, and not us. We can get that reversed pretty easily. Other thoughts? I thought it's on our hand there. Yeah, Rick.
One thing this passage does make clear, along with many other passages in the Bible, is it does matter to God what we offer in the worship.
It makes a difference.
It makes a difference.
Yeah.
The question is, what do we do about that?
Sure.
If it does matter, what is our responsibility?
That's right. To listen. Exactly. I mean, that's what the text was saying. You know, you need to go to the house of God and to listen to what He says. And that's a struggle. That becomes a struggle.
That's something we need to learn in all the aspects
sure.
of life.
Sure.
We need to listen before we speak. We need to think a little bit before we open our mouth.
Right.
And we don't.
Right.
I found a long time ago, if I'm going to get along in my business, I better listen to the client or the person that I'm dealing with first so I know where they're coming from.
Right. Yeah, missed completely.
And so it's the same way when we're dealing with God. Let's not just be telling God how it's going to be. We better listen first.
Sure.
And that's something that's very difficult for a lot of us to learn.
Yeah. Good thoughts tonight, y'all. Appreciate your comments. Lord willing, we'll take up here around verse 4 on Sunday morning and work our way through chapter 5. That's going to be our plan as we go forward. Good to see y'all. Rated you? Okay.